career flourished, Alfonso Taft was rarely able to relinquish the rigid self-discipline that had enabled him to forge a comfortable existence. Scarcely a night would pass that he was not bent over a table deep in papers or books he had brought from his office, biographer Henry Pringle notes. "We might almost as well ask a train of cars to go out of its course to carry a passenger," Delia lovingly observed, "as to expect Mr. Taft to turn aside from his business for the pursuit of pleasure." To Alfonso, work and family were paramount, and in that order. Living on the wooded slope of Mount Auburn, with the entire city below spread out before you like a map, gave the children the advantages of both city and country, Horace recalled. Left to their own devices, the children rambled and explored. In the nearby pond, we learned to swim, but not because anybody taught us. We went fishing or on long hikes. We had plenty of games, but they were not organized. Looking back years later, Horace wished that they had been taught to sail or to rough it, been exposed more to the woods, been challenged by experiences that would have broadened their education. If not adventurous, the life he remembered seemed wholesome and natural. While many citizens of Cincinnati, linked to the South through commerce, sympathized with the Confederacy when the Civil War broke out, Alfonso had long held anti-slavery views. He had been a delegate to the first Republican convention in 1856. And after Ohio's Salmon Chase failed to secure the presidential nomination in 1860, he supported Abraham Lincoln. He sold government bonds, delivered speeches promoting emancipation, and argued government cases against the Copperhead faction at the request of War Secretary Edwin Stanton. When news of Lee's surrender came, the city fairly blossomed with flags, and everybody turned out to join in a rejoicing which included all parties, Louise told her sister. Almost every house on Mount Auburn was lighted to its utmost extent, and many were luxuriously ornamented. Hours after the celebration came word of Lincoln's assassination. The transition from such a jubilee to the unlooked-for calamity of the next morning seemed too great to be believed, she lamented. The symbols of joy which had been universal were turned into mourning, and the city is draped and craped from one end to the other. 8 months after the war ended, Alfonso was appointed to fill a vacancy on the Cincinnati Superior Court bench. The following year, he was elected to a full term on the Republican ticket, and 2 years afterwards was nominated and elected to the court by both Republicans and Democrats. He was a born judge, his son Horace proudly remembered. He had the judicial temperament, the moral courage, the ability, and patience. The most important opinion Judge Taft rendered on the Superior Court upheld the right of the local school board to prohibit the reading of the Bible in public schools. He argued, in a dissenting opinion, that the Constitution of the state did not recognize the Christian religion any more than it recognized the religions of any other citizens of the state, and that the school board had an obligation as well as a right to keep religious partisanship out of the public schools. Alfonso was forever proud of his opinion, even though it prompted intense opposition from conservatives. For Alfonso, nothing equaled the honor of his judicial calling. Indeed, he envisioned no office higher than a seat on the Supreme Court. "To be Chief Justice of the United States," he told Salmon Chase after Lincoln had announced Chase's appointment to the court, "is more than to be president, in my estimation." Nonetheless, after 6 years on the Superior Court, Alfonso recognized that his judicial salary could not meet the expenses involved in educating his large family. Reluctantly, he resigned his judgeship and returned to private practice. No leader of the bar ever left the court feeling that his case had been too difficult or too deep for the judge's understanding and learning, a distinguished lawyer wrote at the time of his resignation. No beginner at the bar ever left feeling that the case had been too small and unimportant for the judge's patience and kindness. Over the years, Alfonso became increasingly involved in the community life of Cincinnati. As a city councilman, he fought to extend the city line to annex a newly built section so that Rich real estate holders living there would have to pay their just share of taxes. He joined future President Rutherford B. Hayes, future Supreme Court Justice Stanley Matthews, and lawyer John W. Herron, Nellie's father, as charter members of the Literary Club. And Alfonso and Louise were instrumental in founding the House of Refuge, a progressive reform school designed to return delinquent children to the path of virtue and integrity. Taking a liberal perspective, Alfonso argued that these children are unfortunate rather than criminal. Their delinquency, he maintained, was not the product of nature, but rather of the cruel circumstances into which they were born. At the suggestion of a group of prominent Republicans, Alfonso allowed his name to be put forward as a candidate for governor. Though he lost at the convention to his friend Rutherford Hayes, in part because of widespread opposition to his position on school prayer, his unblemished reputation for being as honest as the day is long caught the attention of President Grant, who brought him into his cabinet. He served first as Secretary of War, and then as Attorney General during Grant's final months in office, where he was seen as a representative of the reform element against the old regime. While he enjoyed his short stint in Washington, he was happy to return to his beloved Cincinnati and resume the practice of law. Alfonso and Louise supported and expected excellence in their children, pushing them at every level to succeed in their studies. Charlie attended Yale and went on to Columbia Law School. Peter followed his brother to Yale, graduating first in his class with the best record ever achieved to that time. The pressure upon Will, his parents' favorite child, to match the sterling records of his older half-brothers created anxiety. From his grammar school days, he had to work harder than his fellow students to succeed. His tendency to procrastinate when anxious about his assignments further intensified his nervousness. In the afternoons, he was frequently seen reading under a tree on the grassy lawn in front of his house. He was ridiculed by passing neighborhood boys for not playing ball, mocked because he was a fatty, a lubber, who could not keep up in their rough-and-tumble games. "If you can't walk," they taunted, "we'll roll you, old butterball." Refusing to be provoked, he merely smiled and returned to his book. The desire to please his parents became central to young Taft's temperament and development. At the age of 7, he was reading, but his mother had to work with him in arithmetic and writing. "He means to be a scholar and studies well," Alfonso proudly recorded. "I have never had any little boy show a better spirit in that respect." When he fell to 5th in his class, Alfonso tersely declared, "Mediocrity will not do for Will." By the age of 12, his last year in grammar school, he ranked first in his class, earning both his school's highest medal and his father's praise. His average was 95, Alfonso told Delia, and the nearest to him averaged 85. "This was doing uncommonly well and makes us all very happy." His younger brothers were conscientious students as well, placing 2nd and 3rd in their respective classes. "We felt that the sun shone brighter if we brought home good reports," Horace recalled. Each successful performance, however, only fueled higher expectations, giving Will, who drove himself intensely to perform, little peace. Years later, his mother realized the mechanism they had unwittingly fostered. Love of approval, she acknowledged, became her adored son's besetting fault. In the summer of 1869, when Will was 11, Alfonso and Louise sailed to Europe to join their older sons, Charlie and Peter, who were studying and traveling abroad with the aid of $50,000 bequeathed to each upon the death of their maternal grandfather, Judge Phelps. For Charlie, Europe proved life-altering, awakening a love of music, art, and theater that would continue to deepen in the years ahead. Of all the Taft boys, Charlie seemed best able to balance study and relaxation. For Peter, the most brilliant yet brittle of the brothers, the desire to meet his father's expectations produced a chronic state of nervous exhaustion, marked by headaches and eye trouble. His family hoped that the year in Europe would restore his spirits. Will and his younger siblings remained behind during this European sojourn, missing excursions to historical sites in England, Italy, and Germany, that would likely have provided far more vivid and spacious lessons than the daily round of classwork in their local grammar school. In their letters from abroad, the elder Tafts suggested readings that would connect their sons to their various stops along the way. When they reached Liverpool, Louise advised Will to read up in the Gazetteer and Encyclopedia of this the greatest harbor in the world, trusting that the knowledge his parents were there would make his geography real and impressive to him. Writing from Rome, where he had visited the supposed site of Julius Caesar's assassination at the base of Pompey's colossal statue, Alfonso recreated for Will the story of Caesar's rivalry with Pompey and the struggle with the senators that led to his death. In the fall of 1870, Will entered rigorous Woodward High, a public school for college-bound students in downtown Cincinnati. His years there were marked by the same pattern of hard work, procrastination, and an anxiety driven by his need to maintain the family standard of excellence. In his study of Taft's early education, historian David Burton concludes that Will left high school with a mastery of fact and a commitment to disciplined study, rather than a sense of intellectual adventure. Taft's brother Horace, who eventually became a celebrated educator, recalled the educational environment of their childhood home and concluded that the most conspicuous thing about it was its limitations. "My father was very ambitious for all of his children, but, like most Americans of that day, thought of education as a school affair and as connected almost exclusively with the school curriculum. We had no music, no art, no mechanical training, and our reading was done with very little guidance." So long as his children worked hard and performed well, Alfonso believed his obligation regarding their education had been met. The winter of Will's senior year, his brother Charlie, who was then practicing law in Cincinnati, married Annie Sinton, the only daughter of the city's wealthiest man, Iron King David Sinton. Charlie's wedding to Annie Sinton was the great social event of the year. Long afterward, Nellie Heron Taft, 12 at the time, recalled the excitement of the gala staged at the splendid Sinton mansion situated at the top of her street. A long and happy marriage commenced when the young couple moved into the Sinton mansion with Annie's widowed father. Charlie would eventually leave the law to become publisher of the Cincinnati Times, which merged into the Evening Star to form the Times Star, a Taft family holding for the next 7 decades. Over the years, Charlie accrued considerable wealth that would help provide a foundation for Will's public service career. Even as a high school student, Will began to develop a progressive sensitivity informed by the feminist teachings of his mother and grandmother. His inclinations for social justice were reflected in a thoughtful essay he wrote during his senior year. "The result of coeducation of the sexes shows clearly that there is no mental inferiority on the part of the girls," he asserted. These views echoed the liberal views of his mother, who was incensed by an article in the New York Times suggesting that, from their constitutional peculiarities, girls cannot be pushed in school as rapidly as can boys. Moving beyond coeducation, Will argued for women's suffrage. "Give the woman the ballot, and you will make her more important in the eyes of the world. The right to vote," he optimistically predicted, "would beget other benefits. Every woman would then be given an opportunity to earn a livelihood. She would suffer no decrease in compensation for her labor on account of her sex. It becomes this country, as a representative of liberty, to lead in this great reform." Will graduated second in his high school class with an average of 91, earning him an acceptance at Yale. Still, his father expressed concern about his work habits, citing a teacher who believed the only obstacle to Will's achieving great success was laziness. Despite the affection his parents showered on young Will, the impression remains that he never experienced their love as a steady force, but rather as a conditional reward dependent upon his achievements. When he entered Yale, Will stood over 6 feet tall and weighed 225 pounds, quickly earning him the admiring nickname Big Bill. His affable disposition and genial companionship with students of all backgrounds combined to make him the most popular man in the freshman class. To see his large bulk come solidly and fearlessly across the campus, one classmate enthused, is to take a fresh hold on life. Observing him walk through the college auditorium was like seeing a dreadnought launched. When the sophomore class challenged the freshman to a tug-of-war, the freshman team proved seriously outmatched, its members dragged bodily down the field, until Big Bill entered the fray, anchored the rope, and hauled his classmates back, inch by inch, to victory. Academics came less easily for Will. He found his courses in Latin, Greek, and mathematics especially difficult. "I begin to see how a fellow can study all the time and still not have perfect marks," he warned his father, only days after the semester had begun. Nevertheless, when grades were posted after 6 weeks, his tireless efforts placed him in the first division, where he was joined by his good friend from Cincinnati, Howard Hollister. "It is not more than we expected," Louise told Delia. "Now that the best scholars are in one division, the motive for effort, incited by constant comparison with each other, is very strong, inspiring them with unflagging ambition." The added pressure only aggravated Will's distress. There was no respite so long as self-esteem depended on the approval of his parents. "Another week of this damned horrid grind has passed by. I'm somewhat embarrassed in this first division," Taft confessed to his father. "You expect great things of me, but you mustn't be disappointed if I don't come up to your expectations." Despite anxiety provoking high expectations, the fact that Will was able to speak openly to his father about his fears indicates the depth of their relationship. He did not try out for football, baseball, or crew. His father had other ideas, Taft recalled years later, insisting he focus solely on his classwork. Nor was Alfonso pleased to hear that his social son had been elected president of Delta Kappa and taken into Skull and Bones. "I doubt that such popularity is consistent with high scholarship," he warned. Will disagreed. "If a man has to be isolated from his class in order to take a high stand, I don't want a high stand. The presidency of Delta Kapp takes none of my time, except so much as I spend on Saturday night, which I shouldn't use anyhow. There's got to be some relaxation." This brief spark of rebellion was quickly doused as Will settled into a structured regimen that produced the expected academic distinction. Rising at 6:30, he studied before breakfast, followed by prayers, morning recitation, lunch, and afternoon recitation until 3:00. Then he went to the gym for 30 minutes and studied until his last recitation at 5:00. If he had time before dinner, he would stop by the post office in hopes of finding letters from home, and then would work until 10 or even 11. As a scholar, he stood high, fellow classmate Herbert Bowen recalled. More importantly, he towered above us all as a moral force. He was the class leader, directing all manner of college activities, from the literary board to the junior prom. He listened sympathetically to the troubles of his fellow students, who regularly sought his counsel. His fellow students found him safe and comforting, always ready to come up with a cheery bit of wholesome discourse. Without a single dissenting vote, Taft's classmates affectionately appointed him father of their graduating year, and long remembered his perpetual smile and rumbling, hearty laugh. "In sum," Bowen writes, "he was the most admired and respected man, not only in my class, but in all Yale." Nonetheless, David Burton concludes, there was little in his academic training at Yale to suggest that learning was exciting for him, a galvanizing experience. Rather, he was conditioned to regard his subjects as hurdles to be taken on the way to a degree. When a younger student inquired about setting himself a course of outside reading to facilitate a deeper immersion in French and German literature and culture, Taft advised, "Don't do it. Get over it. You mustn't try to be too independent, just yet. These university professors have laid out a course, and it's the result of their long experience. While you, well, this is just your first trial at educating anybody. You'd just better stick to the course." In the spring of his sophomore year, Will delivered an oration on the continued vitality of the Democratic Party, tracing its history from Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson to the present day. Despite his own strong Republican leanings, he could appreciate and praise various Democratic leaders, noting in particular Jackson's hard common sense, which is only acquired by knocking about among the masses. Even at this young age, his biographer observes, Taft was judicial beyond the comprehensions of a Theodore Roosevelt, who not long thereafter would write a paper at Harvard accusing Jefferson of criminal folly and labeling Jackson a spoilsman before anything else. Taft would recall one professor above all, political economist William Graham Sumner, who, he said, had more to do with stimulating my mental activities than anyone under whom I studied during my entire course. Considered one of the most gifted educators of his generation, Sumner lectured to classes packed not only with eager students, but with professors from various universities, seeking the secret of his success. An impassioned advocate of laissez-faire and social Darwinism, of property rights and economic freedom, Sumner was an apostle for the gospel of wealth, the reigning philosophy of the Industrial Revolution and the Gilded Age that followed the Civil War. Sumner passionately rejected concerns about the consolidation of business and the excessive concentration of wealth in the hands of a few, arguing, on the contrary, that wealthy business leaders like John Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, and Cornelius Vanderbilt should be lionized. Through their enterprise, ingenuity, and capital, America had become the world's leading industrial power, capable of building more railroads, producing more oil and steel, manufacturing more clothing, appliances, and consumer goods than any other nation on earth. If we should set a limit to the accumulation of wealth, he argued, we should say to our most valuable producers, we do not want you to do us the services which you best understand how to perform beyond a certain point. It would be like killing off our generals in war. Will absorbed Sumner's central teaching that property rights demanded protection against the onslaught of radical theories and socialist ideals. Like Sumner, he argued that princely profits represented the just reward for the men of judgment, courage, and executive ability who have conceived and executed the great enterprises. Unlike Sumner, however, he did not place the businessman at the highest pinnacle of honor and trust. Nor did he regard property rights as absolute, deserving precedence at every turn over human rights. From his father he had learned that the man who devoted himself to his community, the lawyer who makes man's peace with man, the doctor who makes his peace with nature, the minister who makes his peace with God, deserved greater praise than the man who pursued wealth for its own sake. Wealth was honorable only to the extent that it contributed to the well-being of the community. Honors were showered upon Will during his senior year. His proud father boasted to Delia in late October 1877 that Will had been chosen by his classmates to be class orator, the greatest prize in college, class valedictorian notwithstanding. He has in this respect surpassed his older brothers, Alfonso noted. The honor, too, is of the historical kind, which will not be forgotten by his class. He would have his hands full, however, Alfonso explained, for the class orator was expected to deliver a long speech of half an hour to the class, carefully written and committed and practiced. Almost immediately, as Will anticipated his performance, anxiety set in. 2 months after his selection, with more than 5 months left to prepare, he so agonized over his insufficient progress that he determined to forego Christmas vacation in Cincinnati. We shall regret that Willie cannot come home, but believe he does right in giving time to the great work, Alfonso wrote Delia. I rely on his strength of purpose and of intellect to accomplish it all and raise his reputation every time. As spring approached, Will lamented that his oration was coming on slowly. Though he had settled upon his theme, he had not formulated how to present it. A month later, he was still struggling, finding it rather difficult to adapt its tone to the occasion. Another vacation was thus spent toiling in New Haven, alone. In the end, however, young Taft delivered a splendid oration before an overflow crowd at the Battelle Chapel. The sound of approaching music was heard, the New York Times reported, followed by the measured tramp of the class of 78 as in long line they filed up the aisle and took their places for the last time in their accustomed seats, where they would listen to the address of the class orator. No accolade could have pleased Taft more than the comparisons to his father drawn by the Times. The orator in physique, in the method of handling his subject and in style of oratory, presented some strong resemblances to his distinguished father. The address was characterized throughout by a transparency of thought, a clearness of statement, and an appearance of manly sincerity. In the weeks before his graduation, Will had grown increasingly alarmed and troubled by news that his brother Peter had suffered a nervous breakdown and been committed to a private hospital for the insane. "I wish you could get Peter to come to commencement," he beseeched his father. "We might turn his thoughts back to his college days and ease his mind considerably. President Porter asked about him. I told him that we thought he was suffering from some mental disease." After Peter's return from Europe, he had begun practicing law in Cincinnati. There he met and married Tilly Hulbert, daughter of another prominent and wealthy local family. Unfortunately, his marriage did not share the productive harmony of Charlie's. The union shortly proved disastrous, and his old anxieties multiplied. "Peter continues so strange," his mother confided to her sister. "He is very cross to Tilly and quarrels about everything in the arrangement of the house. He puts in partitions, buys paper, carpets, and furniture, and changes the position of everything in the house in opposition to Tilly's wishes." Tormented by a series of ailments, including wild mood swings and a recurrence of the mysterious eye trouble that rendered him unable to read, Peter began a course of treatment at the sanitarium that left him lonely and restless. "I am doing my best to be reconciled to the treatment in this institution," he wrote his father. "You have thought it best, and whatever your judgment thinks best, I shall obey. But the course here is very hard. The doctor gives me a kind of tonic that heats my head very much and makes my mind so sensitive that any exercise of it deprives me of rest at night. You are proceeding on a mistaken theory in my case. What I need is not to be shut off from you and the family, but to be drawn to you and made to feel your love. It seems to me that I am on a downward path. Whatever is the result of treatment, remember always that I, your son, love you more than I do any living mortal, and I respect your will above all others." Despite the entreaties of both Will and Peter himself, Alfonso decided that Peter should remain in the hospital rather than join the family at Yale. On June 27, 1878, Will Taft was honored as salutatorian of his class, having surpassed all of his 132 classmates, save Clarence Hill Kelsey, who would become a lifelong friend. Even as he prepared to enter Cincinnati Law School the following fall, much of Will's motivation continued to stem from his father's high expectations rather than from any strong internal drive. Indeed, years later, Taft would credit his father's indomitable will and lofty aspirations in prompting his own achievements. When his father lay dying, he shared this enveloping paternal spirit with Nellie. "I have a kind of presentiment that Father has been a kind of guardian angel to me, in that his wishes for my success have been so strong and intense as to bring it, and that as his life ebbs away and ends, I shall cease to have the luck which has followed me thus far." Theodore Roosevelt was born 13 months after Will Taft on October 27, 1858. In a four-story townhouse at No. 28 East 20th Street in Manhattan. Teddy, as he was nicknamed, was, by his own admission, a sickly and timid boy, a wretched mite, whose childhood was shaped by an assortment of troubling ailments, the most dangerous of which was asthma. When these agonizing attacks came, he found himself frantically gasping for breath, terrified he would suffocate. "Nobody seemed to think I would live," he recalled. His younger sister, Corinne, remarked on the irony that Theodore Roosevelt, whose name later became the synonym of virile health and vigor, was a fragile, patient sufferer in those early days of the nursery. His fierce determination to escape an invalid's fate led him to transform his body and timid demeanor through strenuous work, while Taft, blessed from birth with robust health, would allow his physical strength and energy to gradually dissipate over the years into a state of obesity. During the worst of T.D.'s asthmatic attacks, when the constriction in his chest made sleep impossible, his father comforted him with great and loving care. "Some of my earliest remembrances are of nights when he would walk up and down with me," Roosevelt later wrote. "I could breathe, I could sleep, when he had me in his arms." If carrying the gasping child from room to room around the house proved inadequate, Theodore Sr. drove him with horse and carriage through the gaslit city streets, hoping that the chill gusts of wind would fill the boy's lungs with air. "My father, he got me breath, he got me lungs, strength, life." T.D.'s father, known as Thee, was the youngest of five sons born to Margaret and Cornelius Van Schaack Roosevelt, a glass merchant who had amassed a substantial fortune in real estate and banking. Considered one of the five richest men in New York, C.V.S. hired tutors to educate his sons in the basement study of his imposing brick mansion on Union Square. Instead of enrolling Thee in college, which he feared would spoil him, C.V.S. sent him on a grand tour of Europe when he turned 19. Returning from the year abroad, Thee followed his older brother James into the family business. As the years went by, however, his keen sense of social justice began to draw his focus from the firm. Increasingly, he was drawn to philanthropic efforts to improve the lives of the poor at a time when extravagant wealth and abject poverty stood side by side. In 1853, at age 21, Thee married 17-year-old Martha Mitty Bullock, daughter of a high-spirited family from Roswell, Georgia. Mitty had been raised in Bullock Hall, a white-columned antebellum plantation mansion, where every need was attended to by a dozen slaves. The story of their courtship suggests an intense attraction from the moment they met in Roswell, when Mitty was only 15. They renewed their acquaintance when she came north to visit relatives in the spring of 1853, and within weeks they were engaged. A southern beauty with delicate features, blue eyes, black hair, and radiant skin, Mitty possessed a quick mind and playful sense of humor. She proved irresistible to a young man raised amid the staid gentility of the Roosevelt's ordered social world. In June, Thee came to Roswell to meet the members of the large Bullock clan. "I am trying to school myself to coolly shaking hands with you when we meet before the family," Thee told her. After his visit, Mitty assured him she was now confident of her own deep love, confessing that, "Everything now seems associated with you. Even when I run up the stairs, going to my own room, I feel as if you were near, and turn involuntarily to kiss my hand to you. I feel, dear Thee, as though you were part of my existence, and that I only live in your being." Her words so thrilled Thee that he felt the blood rush to his temples, forcing him to lay the letter down for a few minutes to regain command of himself. "Oh, Mitty," he declared, "how deeply, how devotedly I love you." Within 4 months, the young couple settled into their new 20th Street home, one of two adjoining houses that CVS had purchased for Thee and his brother Robert. Here, in the 8 years that followed, four children were born: Anna, who was called Bammy, Theodore, Elliot, and Corinne. The advent of the Civil War, however, blasted the idyllic days of Thee and Mitty's marriage. While Thee passionately supported the Union cause, Mitty remained loyal to her homeland. Her brother, two stepbrothers, and all the young men she had known in Georgia had enlisted in the Confederate Army. Before the outbreak of war, Mitty's widowed mother, Martha, and her sister, Anna, had left Georgia and moved in with Thee and Mitty. Their plantation eventually fell into the hands of Union soldiers. "If I may judge at all of the embittered feeling of the South against the North by myself," Martha told her daughter, "I would say they would rather be buried in one common grave than ever again live under the same government. I am confident I should." The strain of a divided household took a toll on Mitty's health. "I shudder to think of what she must have suffered," Bammy later said. I remember that Mother, for a long time, never came to the dinner table. Unable to bear the inevitable arguments, she withdrew more and more to the sick room, plagued by an assortment of ills, palpitations, stomach troubles, and debilitating headaches. Thee suppressed his impulse to volunteer for the Union Army, fearing that it would destroy his fragile wife, for him to fight against her brothers. Reluctantly, he decided to purchase a substitute. While it seemed the only choice at the time, he always afterwards felt that he had done a very wrong thing, recalled Bammy, in not having put every other feeling aside and joined the absolute fighting forces. Though Thee worked tirelessly on behalf of the Union cause, devoting all his time and abundant energy to the great work of the Sanitary Commission, the Union League, the Allotment Commission, and the Employment Bureau, which found work for soldiers who had lost limbs, the decision not to enlist caused an indelible regret. All four Roosevelt children idolized their father, the most dominant figure in their childhood, especially since their mother's fragility absented her from so many of their activities. "He was the most intimate friend of each of his children," Corinne recalled, "and we all craved him as our most desired companion." Theodore described the joyful anticipation when we used to wait in the library in the evening until we could hear his key rattling in the latch of the front hall, and then rush out to greet him. Bammy was convinced there was never anyone so wonderful as her father, while Elliot marveled that he was one of those rare grown men who seemed never to forget that they were once children themselves. He took the children sailing on the swan boats in Central Park and brought them to museums. He tutored them in riding, first on Shetland ponies and then saddle horses, and in tree climbing, pointing out the dead limbs to avoid. In contrast to Alfonso Taft, who was rarely able to turn aside from his business for the pursuit of pleasure, the elder Theodore Roosevelt skillfully balanced work and leisure in his family's life. "I never knew anyone who got greater joy out of living than did my father," Theodore declared, "or anyone who more wholeheartedly performed every duty." His hard work in both business and philanthropic activities never precluded a rich social life. He reveled in the company of friends at dinner parties, relished a good cigar, danced into the early morning hours, and raced his four-in-hand coach through the streets. While acknowledging the often cruel class divisions that drove Alfonso from New York, he saw the city not so much for what it was as for what it might become under enlightened leadership. In an era when assistance to the poor remained mainly in the hands of private charity, Thee developed a sterling reputation for his dedication to improving the lives of tenement children through his work with the Newsboys Lodging House, the Children's Aid Society, Miss Sattery's School for Italian Children, and the Five Points Mission. "Father was the finest man I ever knew, and the happiest," Roosevelt later told his journalist friend Jacob Riis. Their father's affection and vitality compelled the Roosevelt children to surmount serious physical ailments. Bammy was deformed at birth by a severe curvature of the spine, which gave her a hunchback appearance. Elliot was afflicted by what were considered epileptic attacks. Corinne, like Teedy, suffered from asthma, though her illness was not as severe as her brother's. Concern with the children's health prompted Thee to arrange home tutoring rather than send them to school. They were taught the fundamentals of reading, writing, and arithmetic by Mitty's sister, Anna, but their lifelong love of learning, their remarkable wide-ranging intellectual curiosity, was fostered primarily by their father. He read aloud to them at night, eliciting their responses to works of history and literature. He organized amateur plays for them, encouraged pursuit of their special interests, prompted them to write essays on their readings, and urged them to recite poetry. In addition, their mother provided a romantic and engaging perspective on history through accounts of her childhood in the vanished world of plantations, slaves, and chivalrous codes. Even at a young age, Teedy held a distinct place among his siblings. The asthma that had weakened his body seemed to have inordinately sharpened his mind and sensibilities. From the very fact that he was not able originally to enter into the most vigorous activities, Corinne noted, he was always reading or writing, with a most unusual power of concentration. He especially loved animal stories, adventure tales, and inspiring chronicles of men who were fearless in battle. His voracious reading gave him a rich cache of ideas for stories of his own to entertain his younger brother and sister. "I can see him now, struggling with the effort to breathe," Corinne recalled, describing her 8-year-old brother's winding serial narratives, which never flagged an interest for us, though at times they continued from week to week, or even from month to month. In the summers, Thee sought a broader field of educational activities for his children in the country, moving the family first to the Hudson Valley, and then to Oyster Bay, in a rambling house called Tranquility. Although Corinne Riley observed that anything less tranquil than that happy home, crowded with cousins and friends of all the children, could hardly be imagined. Her friends Edith Carrow and Fanny Smith were regular visitors every summer. To Fanny Smith, these summer sojourns to Oyster Bay seemed a blissful round of riding, driving, boating, picnicking, games, and verse writing. No day was long enough. Fanny was so taken with the extraordinary vitality and gusto with which the Roosevelt family invested life that she felt as if they had all been touched by the flame of the divine fire. In the woodlands surrounding the Roosevelt summer retreat, young Theodore's avocation as a naturalist took shape. As he roamed the forest trails, he began to observe the birds, listening to their distinctive songs, carefully noting flight patterns, beak and bill shapes, and plumage coloration. When his interest expanded to a wide range of animals, he studied in scientific books and then took lessons which his father arranged from a professional taxidermist. He began to collect, prepare, and mount hundreds of meticulously labeled specimens. Encouraged by Thee, he set about establishing his own Roosevelt Museum of Natural History, with the fervent aspiration to become the next J.J. Audubon or Spencer Baird. The expansive education the Roosevelt children enjoyed, with boundaries stretching far beyond the classroom, closely resembled the ideal of learning envisioned by Horace Taft, when he wished that he and his siblings had been exposed to the natural world, to the arts and music, to reading unconfined by pedantic needs and standards. Years later, when Roosevelt was president, he tried to interest Taft in birds and nature. "He loves the woods. He loves hunting," Taft said of Roosevelt. "He loves roughing it. And I don't." On one occasion, when Taft served as Roosevelt's Secretary of War, he entered the Oval Office while Roosevelt was speaking with an ornithologist. Taft was anxious to talk about the Philippine tariff bill, but Roosevelt tried to engage Will in his discussion. "Sit down, Will, and we will talk about something more interesting. We'll tell you something about birds," the president exclaimed. Taft responded with a laugh. "I don't believe that you can interest me in natural history, and I don't want you to send me any more such books as you sent me the other day. I read it because you asked me to, and it took me nearly all night. What do I care about dog wolves, and whether they help she-wolves in procuring food for their young? I don't think I ever saw a wolf, and certainly I'm not interested in their domestic affairs." The same year that Alfonso and Louise traveled abroad without Will and their younger children, Thee and Mitty took 10-year-old Teedy and the entire family to Europe for a 12-month journey through England, Scotland, Holland, Germany, Switzerland, Italy, and France. Though Teedy, affectionately known within the family as a great little homeboy, sorely missed his childhood friends, particularly 8-year-old Edith, his faithful diary entries reveal scores of invigorating adventures. He traversed the fields where the War of Roses was fought, inspected the tombs at Westminster Abbey, stood astride the boundary of France and Italy, ascended Mount Vesuvius, and admired the art treasures of the Vatican. And always, the children were accompanied by books, allowing Teedy occasional opportunity to withdraw into his own world. At the end of 4 months, before the trip was half over, he proudly announced that we three, the three younger siblings, Bammy being considered part of the big people world, had read 50 novels. Beyond works of popular fiction, the family carried a small library of classic history and literature, which Thee read aloud to stir discussion. While the European voyage answered Thee's hopes that a real education for his children would be acquired more easily through travel, He feared that Teedy, whose asthma and stomach troubles had necessitated frequent days of bed rest, was becoming too familiar with illness, timidity, and frailty, too prone to retreat into invalidism. When they returned home, he took his son aside. "Theodore, you have the mind, but you have not the body, and without the help of the body, the mind cannot go as far as it should," he admonished. "You must make your body. It is hard drudgery to make one's body, but I know you will do it." Teedy responded immediately, according to Corinne, giving his father a solemn promise. "I'll make my body." The boy threw himself into a strict regimen of strength and endurance training. Week after week, month after month, he lifted weights and pulled himself up on horizontal bars. Methodically, he sought to expand his chest by regular, monotonous motion. Drudgery indeed. First at Wood's gymnasium, and then in the home gym his father constructed on the second floor. The fierce determination that had propelled Teedy to become a serious student of nature, a voracious reader, and a sensitive observer, was now directed towards expanding his physical capabilities by refashioning his body. Years would pass before the potential of these labors would be actualized in an adult capacity and physique that made him an exemplar of the strenuous life. In the meantime, his physical inferiority made him vulnerable to a humiliating experience that remained fresh in his mind 40 years later. In his autobiography, he recounted a stagecoach ride to Maine, where he was set upon by two mischievous boys who proceeded to make life miserable for him. Attempting to fight back, he discovered that either boy alone could handle him with easy contempt. The injury to his self-respect was such that he was determined never again to be so helpless. In addition to his regular exercise regime, he began taking boxing lessons. "I was a painfully slow and awkward pupil," he recalled, "and certainly worked 2 or 3 years before I made any perceptible improvement whatever." Transforming his body was only one step in the psychological struggle against what he shamefully considered his timid nature. "There were all kinds of things of which I was afraid at first," he acknowledged. "But by acting as if I was not afraid, I gradually ceased to be afraid." As a childhood friend observed, by constantly forcing himself to do the difficult or even dangerous thing, he was able to cultivate courage as a matter of habit, in the sense of repeated effort and repeated exercise of willpower. When Teedy was 14, his family went abroad again. Rather than repeat the heady pace of their first sweep through the continent, they spent an entire winter in Egypt, 3 weeks in Palestine, 2 weeks in Lebanon and Syria, 3 weeks in Athens, Smyrna, and Constantinople, and 5 months in Germany. None of the children benefited more from this remarkable journey than Teedy, whose romantic nature conjured visions of ancient lives entwined with his own. "We arrived in sight of Alexandria," he wrote in his diary. "How I gazed on it! It was Egypt, the land of my dreams. Egypt, the most ancient of all countries. A land that was old when Rome was bright, was old when Babylon was in its glory, was old when Troy was taken. It was a sight to awaken 1,000 thoughts, and it did." In addition to the cultural sights, young Theodore was thrilled by the chance to observe and catalog exotic species he had hitherto known only in books. This was his first real collecting as a student of natural history. During their 2-month journey along the Nile in a private vessel, staffed by a 13-man crew, furnished with comfortable staterooms and a dining salon, he was able clearly to perceive the habits of these entirely new birds and animals at close range. For finally, he had been fitted with spectacles that corrected his severe nearsightedness. "I had no idea," he later said, "how beautiful the world was until I got those spectacles." In the mornings, he and his father would go out shooting along the banks of the Nile, retrieving specimens to be skinned, dissected, preserved with chemicals, and labeled. "My first knowledge of Latin was obtained by learning the scientific names of the birds and mammals which I collected and classified." His early dedication to such pursuits revealed an almost ruthless single-mindedness where his interests were aroused. Biographer Carlton Putnam observed, suggestive of a purposeful, determined personality. Summer found the children in Dresden, where their father had arranged for them to live with a German family. Throughout that summer and into the early fall, the daughter of the hosts was hired to teach them the German language, literature, music, and art. Tidi was so earnestly focused upon his studies, which occupied 6 hours of the day, that he asked to extend the lessons further. And, of course, his younger brother Elliot complained, "I could not be left behind, so we are working harder than ever in our lives." In the course of the year abroad, young Theodore had traveled by ship and by train, by stagecoach and on foot. He had stayed in hotels, inns, tents, and private homes. Armed with innate curiosity and a discipline fostered by his remarkable father, he had obtained a first-hand knowledge of the peoples and cultures in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. 40 years later, Roosevelt remained appreciative of the opportunity afforded him. "This trip," he wrote in his autobiography, "formed a really useful part of my education." The family returned to a new home at 6 West 57th Street, a stately mansion with a fully equipped gymnasium for the children and a large space set aside in the garret to house Teedy's ever-expanding taxidermy collection. While the 15-year-old's travels abroad had given him an unusually strong foundation in natural science, history, geography, and German, he was, in his own words, lamentably weak in Latin and Greek and mathematics. If he wished to enter an Ivy League school, he could not compete with students like Will Taft, who had mastered the strenuous program at Woodward High that fully prepared him for Yale. To fill the gaps in Teedy's learning and prepare him for Harvard's rigorous entrance examinations, his father hired a recent Harvard graduate, Arthur Cutler. Under Cutler's tutelage, Teedy worked long hours every day and completed 3 years of college preparation in 2. "The young man never seemed to know what idleness was," marveled Cutler, "and every leisure moment would find the last novel, some English classic, or some abstruse book on natural history in his hands." Elliot also studied under the guidance of a tutor, but lacking his brother's inner motivation and self-confidence, he proved unable to master subjects on his own. Even at 13, he worried about his future. "What will I become when I am a man?" he plaintively demanded of his father. Acknowledging that Teedy was much quicker and a more sure kind of boy, he pledged that he would "try to be as good, if it is in me, but it is hard." Desiring perhaps to separate himself from daily competition with his brother, Elliot entreated his father to send him to St. Paul's Preparatory School. The summer before his entry, however, he suffered a series of mysterious seizures, rooted, doctors believed, in a nervous disorder. Thee decided to postpone St. Paul's, choosing instead to take his son to Europe on a business trip. In Liverpool, however, Elliot suffered another attack, more severe than any previous incident. It produced congestion of the brain, with all its attendant horrors of delirium, etc., Thee reported to Mitty. 2 weeks later, Elliot remained ill. "I jump involuntarily at the smallest sound," he confided in a letter to Teedy, "and have a perpetual headache, and nearly always in low spirits." Returning home, Elliot resumed working with his tutor, but his hopes were still set on St. Paul's, where, he wrote his father, he could make more friends rather than studying at home. "Oh, father, will you ever think me a noble boy? You are right about Teedy. He is one, and no mistake, a boy I would give a good deal to be like in many respects." That fall, Thee agreed to let Elliot go to boarding school, but only a few weeks after arriving, he again fell ill. "During my Latin lesson, without the slightest warning," he told his father, "I had a bad rush of blood to my head. It hurt me so that I can't remember what happened. I believe I screamed out." The boarding school experiment ended 2 months later, when he fainted just after leaving the table and fell down. Teedy was sent to St. Paul's to bring him home. Believing that a vigorous physical regimen would help, Thee sent him to an army post in Texas that built up his body, but did little to cure his nervous disorder. Meanwhile, T.D.'s systematic effort to prepare himself for Harvard paid off. "Is it not splendid about my examinations?" he triumphantly wrote Bammy. "I passed well on all the 8 subjects I tried." If he was intellectually prepared for college, however, he lacked the social skills of many of his fellow students. Years of ill health and homeschooling had isolated him from regular contact with boys and girls outside his family circle. He entered Harvard at scarcely 5 feet 8 inches tall and only 130 pounds, a slender, nervous young man with side whiskers, eyeglasses, and bright red cheeks. While Will Taft's sturdy physique, genial disposition, and empathetic manner won immediate popularity at Yale, Theodore Roosevelt took longer to establish a core group of friends at Harvard. He worried initially about the antecedents of the people he met, maintaining distance from classmates until he could determine whether their families shared the Roosevelts' station in life. One contemporary remembers him as studious, ambitious, eccentric, not the sort to appeal at first. He filled the shelves in his room with snakes and lizards, stuffed birds and animals. The smell of formaldehyde followed him from one class to the next. At a time when indifference toward one's studies was in vogue, Theodore was blatantly enthusiastic. It was not often that any student broke in upon the smoothly flowing current of their professor's lectures, one classmate recalled, but Roosevelt did this again and again, posing questions and requesting clarification until finally one professor cut him short. "Now look here, Roosevelt. Let me talk. I'm running this course." He also had a curious habit of dropping into classmates' rooms for conversation. Rather than joining in, however, he would retreat to a corner and immerse himself in a book as if seated alone on a tree stump in the middle of the forest. Furthermore, he scorned fellow students who drank or smoked. No man ever came to Harvard more serious in his purpose to secure, first of all, an education, recalled his classmate Curtis Guild, Jr. He was forever at it, and probably no man of his time read more extensively or deeply, especially in directions that did not count on the honor list or marking sheet. Whereas Taft discouraged the young Yale student from extracurricular reading, fearful it would detract from required courses, Roosevelt read widely, yet managed to stand near the top of his class. The breadth of his numerous interests allowed him to draw on knowledge across various disciplines, from zoology to philosophy and religion, from poetry and drama to history and politics. "My library has been the greatest possible pleasure to me," he wrote to his parents during his freshman year, "as whenever I have any spare time I can immediately take up a book. Aunt Annie's present, The History of the Civil War, is extremely interesting." From early childhood he had regarded books the greatest of companions. And once encountered, texts were never forgotten. Greeting a Chinese delegation when he was president, he suddenly remembered a book about China encountered many years before. "As I talked, the pages of the book came before my eyes," he said, "and it seemed as though I were able to read the things therein contained." Taft was continually amazed how Roosevelt found time to read, snatching moments while waiting for lunch or his next appointment. He always carried a book with him to the executive office, Taft noted. And although there were but few intervals during the business hours, he made the most of them in his reading. Charles Washburn, a classmate at Harvard, considered Roosevelt's ability to concentrate a signal ingredient to his success. "If he were reading," observed Washburn with astonishment, "the house might fall about his head. He could not be diverted." The habits of mind Roosevelt developed early in his academic career served him well throughout his life and career. As soon as he received an assignment for a paper or project, he would set to work, never leaving anything to the last minute. Preparing so far ahead freed his mind from worry and facilitated fresh, lucid thought. During the last months of his presidency, aware that he was committed to speak at Oxford University following his year-long expedition to Africa, he finished a complete draft of his lengthy address. "I never knew a man who worked as far in advance of what was to be done," marveled Taft. "Perhaps I value this virtue more highly because I lack it myself." While posting honor grades each semester, Roosevelt cultivated a boggling array of social activities. He persevered in the promise to make his body, exercising rigorously day after day. He spent hours in the gym, vaulting and lifting weights. He competed for the lightweight cup in boxing and wrestling, rode on the Charles River, played strenuous games of lawn tennis, and ran 3 or 4 miles a day. Like his father, he pursued his chosen pastimes with the same zeal he devoted to his work. He organized a whist club and a finance club, at which William Graham Sumner appeared. He wrote for The Advocate, joined the Rifle Club and the Arts Club, taught Sunday school, and took a weekly dancing class. With his explosive energy, he danced, just as you'd expect him to dance if you knew him, a contemporary recalled. He hopped. And despite this overcharged agenda, he maintained his passionate interest in birds, watching and shooting them in the field during the days, stuffing and labeling them in his room at night. His college life broadened every interest, Corinne observed, and did for him what had hitherto not been done, which was to give him confidence in his relationship with young men of his own age. If he lacked Taft's immediate charisma, gradually his classmates could not resist the spell of his highly original personality. "Funnily enough, I have enjoyed quite a burst of popularity," he told his mother after his election into several social clubs, including the Hasty Pudding Club, the DKE Society, and the prestigious Porcellian Club. Theodore's burgeoning self-assurance and involvement in the Harvard community came at a critical time. He would need all the resilience and support he could muster to cope with a shattering blow during his sophomore year, when his 46-year-old father came down with a fatal illness. An intense love had continued to bind father and son while T.D. was in college. "As I saw the last of the train bearing you away the other day," Roosevelt had written his son after seeing him off for his freshman year, "I realized what a luxury it was to have a boy in whom I would place perfect trust and confidence, who was leaving me to take his first independent position in the world." T.D.'s reply reflected his own profound respect and devotion. "I do not think there is a fellow in college who has a family that love him as much as you all do me. And I am sure that there is no one who has a father who is also his best and most intimate friend, as you are mine." With unabashed affection, T.D. addressed his frequent letters to his darling father, or his dearest father, and Thee returned the tenderness in kind. 2 months before Roosevelt Sr. was taken ill, he had been nominated by President Rutherford B. Hayes to replace incumbent Chester A. Arthur as Collector of Customs for the Port of New York. His nomination was seen as a triumph for civil service reformers over Senator Roscoe Conkling, who had run the port as his special fiefdom for years. The distinguished position required the approval of the Senate, however, where a fierce battle raged for weeks between the reform element of the Republican Party, represented by Hayes and Roosevelt, and the machine politicians, represented by Conkling and Arthur. In the end, the machine politicians won. The Senate rejected Roosevelt's nomination, insisting instead on the reappointment of Arthur. "The machine politicians have shown their color," a disappointed Thee wrote T.D. "I fear for your future. We cannot stand so corrupt a government for any great length of time." 6 days after his rejection by the Senate, Theodore Sr. collapsed. Doctors diagnosed an advanced stage of bowel cancer. Over Christmas vacation, when T.D. was home, he seemed very much better, sparking the false hope that he was beginning to recover. As T.D. was leaving to return to Harvard, he had a conversation with his father that he would long remember. "Today," he told me, "I had never caused him a moment's pain. I should be less than human if I ever had, for he is the best, wisest, and most loving of men, the type of all that is noble, brave, wise, and good." The final days of Thee's 2-month bout with cancer produced excruciating pain. His groans reverberated through the house, and his dark hair turned gray. Elliot stayed by his father's side, ready to bring a handkerchief drenched in ether to his face. When he screamed, neither the ether nor the sedatives could still the pain, however, and the fear in his father's eyes was terrible for the 16-year-old boy to behold. On Saturday, February 9th, 1878, the family, who had shielded Teedy from the worsening situation, sent an urgent message for him to come home. He raced to catch the overnight train, but reached New York on Sunday morning to find his father had died late Saturday night. His grief was doubly bitter, he wrote. I was away in Boston when the man I loved dearest on earth died. Remembering how his father's devoted strength had comforted him throughout the worst of his childhood attacks, he was filled with unbearable remorse. I never was able to do anything for him during his last illness. The death of Mr. Roosevelt was a public loss, stated the New York Times. Flags flew at half-mast all over the city, noted reporter Jacob Rees. Rich and poor followed him to the grave, and the children whose friend he had been wept over him. Newsboys from the lodging house, orphans for whom he had found homes, and Italian girls he had taught in Sunday school, all grieved for their kind benefactor. There was truly no end to a life that had been devoted to such philanthropy, Reverend William Adams declared at his funeral. For the work he had laid out would remain and grow in power long after his death. He has just been buried, Theodore wrote in his diary. I felt as if I had been stunned, or as if part of my life had been taken away. And the 2 moments of sharp, bitter agony, when I kissed the dear dead face and realized he would never again on this earth speak to me or greet me with his loving smile, and then when I heard the sound of the first clod dropping on the coffin. 10 days later, back at Harvard, his loss still struck him like a hideous dream. Semi-annual examinations offered some distraction to get through the days, but the restless nights were filled with misery. It has been a most fortunate thing for me that I have had so much to do, he wrote in his diary. If I had very much time to think, I believe I should almost go crazy. He was grateful for the small margin of relief his insular college world offered, realizing that his mother and siblings had nothing to assuage their grief. Returning home to Oyster Bay that summer was difficult. For every nook and corner about the place, every piece of furniture about the house is in some manner connected with him. Only frenzied activity managed to keep his sorrow at bay. In late June, however, he confided to his diary a surprising recognition of his own character. "Am leading the most intensely happy and healthy out-of-doors life, and spending my time riding on horseback, making long tramps through woods and fields after specimens, or else on the bay, rowing or sailing, generally in a half-naked condition and with my gun along. I could not be happier, except at those bitter moments when I realize what I have lost. Father was himself so invariably cheerful that I feel it would be wrong for me to be gloomy. And besides, fortunately or unfortunately, I am of a very buoyant temper, being a bit of an optimist." Nevertheless, Theodore remained painfully aware of the magnitude of his loss. His father had been the only human being to whom I told everything, he wrote, never failing to get loving advice and sweet sympathy in return. No one but my wife, if ever I marry, will ever be able to take his place. Perhaps this fundamental loneliness contributed to Theodore's ardent pursuit of 17-year-old Alice Hathaway Lee during his junior year at Harvard. He later claimed that when they first met at the home of his college friend Richard Saltonstall, it was a real case of love at first sight. And my first love, too. Like the first flush of his father's infatuation with Mitty, it seemed as if Theodore's passion for Alice far exceeded his genuine knowledge of her. While his diary is rife with descriptions of her bewitching beauty, scant space is devoted to shared sympathies or interests that might lead to lasting companionship. Within 4 weeks of their introduction, he vowed to win her. 7 months later, when he was only 20, he proposed, and initially she rejected him. He was undeterred. The campaign he launched to gain Alice's love necessitated a full-blown battle plan. Theodore later told a friend he made everything subordinate to winning her. Weekend after weekend, he rode his horse 6 miles to her country home in Chestnut Hill. He took her sledding and skating, read to her, accompanied her on long walks in the woods, and escorted her to dances. He worked to ingratiate himself with her parents and mesmerized her young brother with exciting tales of adventure. Meanwhile, he made every attempt to integrate her into his sphere, introducing her to his friends at the Porcellian and inviting her to join his family for a round of parties in New York. Still, she hesitated to make a commitment at such a young age. Only in the privacy of his diary did young Theodore acknowledge the tortures he was suffering. His wooing of Alice had the aspect of an epic quest in which he was the hero, a crusade in which he would succeed or die. "I have hardly had one good night to rest, and night after night I have not even gone to bed. I have been pretty nearly crazy over my wayward, willful darling." Finally, in late January of his senior year, she agreed to become his wife, and they set a wedding date for the following autumn. "I am so happy that I dare not trust my own happiness," he wrote. "I do not believe any man ever loved a woman more than I love her." Captivated by his first love, he believed there was nothing on earth left to wish for. Despite the absorption in his engagement, Theodore continued to wrestle and box. He joined a hunting expedition in Maine and had a royally good time with his clubmates. He completed a thesis on equalizing men and women before the law that shared the same progressive attitude toward women as Taft's senior essay. As regards the laws relating to marriage, there should be the most absolute equality preserved between the two sexes, Theodore wrote. "I do not think the woman should assume the man's name. I would have the word obey used not more by the wife than by the husband." Unlike young Taft, however, he was not ready to recommend women's suffrage. Nor did he neglect his regular classwork, applying himself sufficiently to graduate magna cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa, 21st in a class that opened with 230 students. Still dividing his classmates according to their family's standing, he boasted that only one gentleman stands ahead of me. As he approached graduation, he reflected on his college years with self-satisfaction. "I have certainly lived like a prince," he wrote in his diary. "I have had just as much money as I could spend, belonged to the Porcellian Club, have had some capital hunting trips, my life has been varied, I have kept a good horse and cart, I have had half a dozen good and true friends in college, and several very pleasant families outside, a lovely home, and to crown all, infinitely above everything else put together, I have won the sweetest of girls for my wife. No man ever had so pleasant a college course." The prospect of marriage altered his long-cherished plan to become a naturalist, a course that would require years of study abroad and was unlikely to provide a substantial income. Instead, he decided to enter Columbia Law School, vowing to do my best and work hard for my own little wife. From that point on, Putnam writes, natural history was to remain a genuine avocation, but it never loomed again as a feasible career. By the age of 21, Theodore had known, in his own words, great sorrow and great joy. And while he believed the joy has far overbalanced the sorrow, his early suffering had deepened his self-knowledge, intensified his powers of concentration, and heightened his sensibilities. Both Will and Teedy had the good fortune of growing up as favored children in close-knit, illustrious families, where affection and respect abounded. Both inherited from their fathers legacies of honorable and distinguished careers, as well as a commitment to public service and a dedication to the Republican Party. Where Will developed an accommodating disposition to please a living father, who cajoled him to do more and do better, Teedy forever idolized a dead father who had paid for a substitute for himself during the Civil War to placate his wife, yet had fostered military and historical tales of heroism in his beloved son. Will had the stronger physical endowment, but the weaker self-control. Teedy, the weaker body, but the greater strength of will. The enormously powerful Will abused his physical gift. The smaller Teedy, a heroic compensator, toughened and transformed his body. Will tended to stay indoors. Teedy tested himself outdoors against nature. Taft was easygoing and even-tempered. Roosevelt perpetually in motion, as if to keep self-inquiry at bay. Will, by temperament, warmer and more sociable than Teedy, found common ground with one and all. Others instinctively responded to his smiling countenance and kindly demeanor. Teedy was less approachable at first blush, limiting his associations to those who shared his class and station in life. Where Teedy was an intellectual adventurer with a passion for reading and a wide-ranging curiosity engendered by a broad set of experiences, Will worked methodically, within the defined frameworks outlined by his instructors. The one was self-assured, guided by his own ferocious determination, the other more subject to the entreaties of others, steering his course out of the desire to please. Will was more modest and straightforward, Teedy more boastful and complex. Common to both was a sober good sense and a willingness to work hard that led to high distinction in college and the promise of success as they looked forward to law school. If there are splendid traits in abundance in the characters of both young men, the one major distinction at this stage is that Teedy had shown he could come through agonizing misfortune. Will had not yet been tested by adversity. Chapter 3. The Judge and the Politician. For William Howard Taft, law school fortified his life's ambition to become a judge, fixing upon him a judicial habit of thought and action that marked the rest of his life as he moved from the bench to the far less congenial world of politics. For Theodore Roosevelt, the study of law merely facilitated his diverse ventures as historian, assemblyman, rancher, civil service commissioner, police commissioner, assistant secretary of the Navy, soldier, governor, and vice president. Each experience would eventually contribute vitally to a memorable presidency. Cincinnati Law School, where Taft matriculated in 1878, was among the oldest in the country. Situated at that time in the Mercantile Library Building at the city center, it remained an old-style institution, untouched by the modern case method of instruction introduced at Harvard earlier in the decade. While Taft could easily have gained admission to Harvard or Yale, he chose to return to his hometown, enveloped by the warmth of his close-knit family. His brothers Charlie and Peter were practicing law in his father's firm, Harry was a student at Yale, Horace a senior at Woodward High, and Fanny was still a girl of 13. Furthermore, Will's best friend and Yale classmate, Howard Hollister, entered Cincinnati Law in the same class. For 2 hours every day, Taft and 66 fellow students listened to professors expound broad legal principles derived from standard texts. The curriculum, far less demanding than his courses at Yale, allowed students to work as well as study. While most law students gained their first practical experience apprenticing in law offices, Taft decided he could learn more about the workings of the law as a court reporter for Murat Halstead's local newspaper, the Cincinnati Commercial. Once his morning lectures were completed, he began his rounds to the police court, the probate court, the district court, and the superior court. At each venue, he took notes, listed the cases on the various dockets each day, and wrote up short accounts of the half-dozen most compelling cases. Readers of the Courts column followed the cases of a husband suing for divorce after discovering his wife had two husbands, a buxom woman ensnared by a livery stable keeper who failed to reveal that he suffered from a contagious private disease, a husband alleging that his wife had struck and scratched him in a vicious manner and had so ill-treated their children that their lives were endangered. He chronicled criminal trials for larceny, domestic abuse, assault and battery, and followed malpractice suits, contested wills, bastardy cases, contract disputes, and mortgage foreclosures. He wrote in a clear, straightforward style, emphasizing the facts of the cases without embellishment. Usually, he managed to complete these accounts before dinner, allowing him time to relax in the evenings. In his early 20s, Will found himself the center of a lively set of young friends.